Okay, gedämpft everyone, gedämpft. It's a very intimate setting, so maybe I'll make it even more informal, acoustic style, unplugged. So every Yom Tov has its identity and has the event that it commemorates. And they're all autonomous, and each event is captured in its own date and its own dynamic. But Chazal sends the synergy between two in particular, the two Yom Tovim of the 15th day, between Sukkos and Pesach. And this cross-pollination is well understood, because the two primary themes of Sukkos were each launched on Pesach. The two primary themes, the seminal themes of Sukkos, are protection, providence, revelation, and encounter. That's the core of the machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Eliezer. Were these huts of protection, or were they huts of encounter? Was the material wood? Was the material clouds of glory? Was the purpose to preserve the safety of the Jewish people in the desert, or to enable an encounter? Those two experiences began Pesach night. Pesach night, for the first time in over 200 years, Jews bestrode Egypt freely. It was a Leil Shimur, it was a night of protection. They were no longer vulnerable, no longer susceptible to enslavement, to persecution. So protection begins the night of Pesach. And Sukkos, where the duration during the desert incorporates that environment of protection on a daily basis. What was overt and explicit the night of Pesach became routine, and became routine during the journey through the desert. It's a little hard to find, but
only a little.
The journey through the desert. The journey through the desert. And the second big theme of Sukkos, the encounter with Kodesh Baruch Hu Shechina, the Anani HaKavod, the night of Pesach. Maybe we'll wait a moment for everyone to walk in and take a pause. Okay, welcome, welcome, everyone. Okay, the door sheet has been handed out of the door. Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome. Maybe I'll stand. There are some source sheets. I think Ariel has some for those who haven't received. Oops. There's Ariel. Okay, pass them around. Pass them around. Please help yourself. Okay, so we're just discussing the synergy between Pesach and between Sukkot. And the two main themes of Sukkot were launched from Pesach. The first theme of protection and providence, the Kodesh Baruch Hu Sashkacha. Shalom, I'm on Galu. Galu, a little plug, is speaking a little bit later tonight.
Thank you. 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. Okay, we'll start again as everyone makes their way in. Welcome, welcome everyone. Okay, I think we have to start again.
She just finished upstairs, just to the shoe.
Oh, yeah, I also finished. Okay.
A few minutes ago.
Okay, come on in everyone.
We have to finish.
Come on in everyone.
It takes 15 minutes to walk up 8,000 steps.
4,000 years of history. Okay, so as we were saying, the themes start again the third time. Welcome, everyone. The themes of Sukkot, of providence, Hashem's Hashkama, and revelation, Gilui Shechina, debated by Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, were these Sukkot in the desert? Were they fashioned and constructed from wood or other materials, or were they constructed from clouds of glory and Anei HaKavod? They represent two different complementary themes of Sukkot. On the one hand, Hashem protected us in the desert, and He continues to protect us. On the other hand, please sit down. On the other hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu enabled that encounter throughout the desert, that rendezvous between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Each of these experiences began the night of Pesach. The night of Pesach was the first time the Jewish people were protected after 200 years of slavery, 200 years of persecution, 200 years of discrimination. The night of Pesach is referred to as Leil Shimurim, the night of being protected. So Sukkot is an extension of Pesach. Pesach was overt. Sukkot was a routinization or an incorporation on a daily basis. Pesach night was also the first mass revelation. People mistakenly think the first mass revelation was at Har Sinai. The first time HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who had been transcendent beyond history, descended into history, was in Mitzrayim. It's a beautiful medrash. That's the last place you'd expect HaKadosh Baruch Hu to reveal himself. A place which was full of dead people. Yeah, please. Place which was full of dead people and shrines to pagan idols. You'd think Hashem should reveal himself to his people for the first time in history in Israel, in the Beis HaMikdash, perhaps in a desert. But the first time HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to us is in a cesspool with dead bodies. because that's where the Jewish people are. And that's a sign of his love for us, that wherever you are, I will follow. Wherever you travel, I travel. Please take some stools. I think we're out of chairs. So there's a lot of synergy between Pesach and between Sukkot, because the themes of Sukkot were launched the night of Pesach. Chazal, please come on in. Just take some stools and sit around. Chazal sensed this synergy, and they equated the two in source number, if you take a look at your source sheets, source number one, Amar Rabbi Yochanan Yishur Rabbi Shimon Ben Yod Sadat, Ne'emar Kan Chamisha Asar, Ve'ne'emar Chamisha Asar B'chag HaMatzel. Both Sukkot and Pesach are tagged as Chamisha Asar. Why is that important? Just like the first night of Pesach, there's an obligation to eat matzah. The rest of the day is optional. You can't consume chametz, but you don't have to. There's no obligation to eat matzah beyond the first night. Similarly, the first night of Sukkot, Tevav, there's an obligation to eat a kezayit in the sukkah. Most of us come from Chutz La'aretz, and we have fond memories of waiting out the rain the first night. The other nights, we don't wait out the rain. If it's raining, some of us are happy, some of us are less happy, to conduct our meal inside. But that first night, we're on the clock. 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, see those drips. Timing, when's the best time to run out into the sukkah and get that? This comes from this Gemara. Because there's an equation between the first night of Pesach and the first night of Sukkot. Tetvav, Tetvav. So that's a halachic encapsulation of the synergy between Pesach and Sukkot. There's a thematic cross-pollination. Revelation and protection both began the night of Pesach. They extended through the desert in these supernatural huts which HaKadosh Baruch Hu sheltered us with. But this is a halachic implementation of that overlap. The first night of Pesach, we have to eat matzah. First night of Sukkot, we have to eat a kezayit in the Sukkot. There's a more ambitious attempt to fuse Pesach and Sukkot, one which fails, but it's very intriguing in its ambition. Source number two, the Sifra says, I think we may be out of source sheets, so I'll take that into account as the shiur unfolds. There's an attempt to obligate eating matzah the first day of Sukkot. Does anyone have that minute? There's a residual of this medrash. The medrash suggests that the 2 days are so integrated that perhaps on the Tetvav of Tishrei, we should behave as if it's the Tetvav of Nisan and consume matzah. That's listed in source number two, line number three. Zeh she'ein talm sukkah, talm matzah. A day that doesn't require a sukkah, you eat matzah. Namely Pesach. Zeh she'ein sukkah, a day that you send the sukkah, you should still eat matzah. If you eat matzah on Pesach without a sukkah, you should still eat matzah on sukkah with a sukkah. This association fails, but as some of you may know, there is a residual minhag that some people have to eat matzah based on the Vilna Gaon. One Sukkot, Tetvav, the first day, to take out a little piece of matzah to highlight this fusion between the 2 days. So to summarize, for everyone who found their way bravely, there's this.
Many people have come to the shiur downstairs.
That's why we're summarizing. There's an overlap between Pesach. Please feel free to come in. I think we're out of stools. Maybe girls, if you can pass over some of the stools. Okay. Let's do this quickly. Here, want to help me? Can I just help pass the stools around? Thanks. Okay, now, one of the interesting similarities, maybe it's over there. One of the interesting similarities between Pesach and Sukkot, beyond this verb, beyond this term, tetvav, tetvav, which fuses the two, it's a very interesting theme, which emerges independently in the discussion about Sukkot and in the discussion about Pesach. When the Torah describes the mitzvah of residing in the Sukkah, it employs a very, very unique phrase. Source number four, line number two, Basukkot teshvu shivat yamim, kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael, yeshvu basukkot. Every citizen should reside in the Sukkah. Now Chazal sends this as a messianic foreshadowing. One day there will actually be a Sukkah, the Leviathan, that will house every Jew, or at least every righteous Jew. But the Gemara Iva, or the Gemara, extracts a very intriguing halachic data from this halacha. The Gemara wants to know, do you have to own a sukkah? You have to own a lulav. You have to own your dalad minim. Can you sit in a sukkah which isn't yours? You can't take dalad minim which aren't yours, unless in the first day. The Gemara responds, you can sit in a sukkah that isn't yours, because this vision the Torah casts of everyone sitting in one sukkah, it's impossible for everyone to own that sukkah. So it must be that everyone sits in one sukkah. Some of the people who reside in that sukkah don't own it and are sitting as guests of the hosts of the sukkah. This is the Gemara's conclusion, source number 3. Dichsiv, kol azrach b'Yisrael, second to last line, v'lamei shekol Yisrael v'ruyim l'shei b'sukkah achat. And that scenario can't be actualized with everyone owning that sukkah. That would be monetarily impossible. So the Gemara's conclusion is that a borrowed sukkah, a sukkah you don't own, is sufficient. So that's the Gemara's halachic extraction, but the scenario is a riveting one. Every single Jew sitting together under one sukkah, and one day that scenario, which is only theoretical, the Gemara is playing with it theoretical, will actualize, will materialize. That same theme of collective experience, of everyone sitting in one sukkah, emerges, not incidentally, regarding the Karban Pesach as well. When the Torah describes the mitzvah of Shechitas Karban Pesach, I didn't quote the pasuk, but it's embedded in a Gemara, source number 5, line number 2. V'shachatu oto, kol, kehal, adas, Yisrael. The entire nation will shech the Karban Pesach. Now that's almost technically impossible for everyone to shech the Karban Pesach, because you can't shech the karban that you can't consume by midnight. So inevitably, people join together in sacrificing the Karban Pesach. So the Gemara in Kiddushin extracts a different halacha conclusion from this image of everyone shechting a joint Karban Pesach. The Meshua ben Karcha, some say he was the son of Rabbi Akiva, Meshua ben Karcha says, source number 5, Minayin shesluchu shalavim kemasa. The agency of shlichut is one of the most ubiquitous halachic mechanisms in all of Shas. Almost any halachic activity can be dispatched or executed through a shliach. I can marry a woman through a shliach. I can divorce a woman through a shliach. I can acquire something through a shliach. Where does shlichus come from? It comes from this pasuk, because the scenario described is everyone shechting Karban Pesach. Inevitably, only a few people shech the Karban Pesach. Not everyone, but it's as if everyone is shechting the Karban Pesach. So we've uncovered an additional overlap between Sukkot and Pesach. Chazal were intrigued by the Tetvav-Tetvav fusion. They both occur on the 15th. They suggested that the same obligational nature of the first night of Pesach is extrapolated to the first night of Sukkot. There was even a hava mina to eat matzah on the first day of Sukkot, which resides as a minhag, or as a residual minhag, lasts as a lingering minhag. But there's another common interplay between Sukkot and Pesach. Collective experience. Kol Ezrach Yishvu Basukot. Everyone sits under one sukkah. V'shachatu oto. Kol Kehal Adas Yisrael. Everyone shechs the Karban Pesach. What's the difference between this inclusion of a sukkah and the broad spectrum experience of Karban Pesach? What's the difference between this collectivism of everyone sitting in a sukkah and the collectivism of everyone sacrificing a Karban Pesach? I want to discuss three differences. Number one, the image described of a Karban Pesach is of individuals abrogating their identity and assuming a collective consciousness, a consciousness beyond themselves. That pasuk doesn't describe individuals. V'shachatu oto, kehal, adas, Yisrael. There's no mention of any individual. Now, of course, in real time, individuals are sacrificing on behalf of other individuals, and the magic of Shlichus renders it as if everyone has shechted a Karban Pesach. But the description of the Pasuk doesn't address individuals. Karban Pesach is a reincarnation on an annual basis of that covenant the Jewish people engaged in, formed with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, a covenant of history. A covenant, as the Rav spoke about, the Rav used to speak extensively about that word, Edah. V'nislach l'chol adas b'nei Yisrael, ki l'chol ha'am b'shkaga. We belong to a tribe, the common past, a joint destiny, and for so many of us living in Israel, raises consciousness and sensitivity towards that collective identity, to that verticality, that we come from something, and we're forerunners of some future, and we belong to something beyond ourselves, and we abdicate personal identity on behalf of a collective consciousness. So the Korban Pesach demands that we almost ignore our personal identity in the search for that collective experience of Kahal, Anas, Yisrael, without for the moment discriminating between the three. Those three are very different terms. We don't have enough time, and certainly don't have enough space to discriminate between those three terms. It feels like we've got the whole Kahal, Anas, Yisrael. It's always hot enough. And in fact, the methodology of sacrificing the Korban Pesach resembled the loss of personal identity in favor of a collective identity. Based on those three verbs, the Gemara says as follows. Source number 6. HaPesach Nishrat, B'Shalosh Kitos. There were 3 shifts of the Korban Pesach. Why 3? Because of those 3 terms. Shift number 1, the Kahal shift. Shift number 2, the Adas shift. Shift number 3, the Yisrael shift. Now, it's very interesting how you decided which shift to belong to, or which shift to send your shliach in for, but there were 3 shifts. Not only were there 3 shifts because of the 3 terms of collective experience which the Pasuk employs, but at each stage, for each shift, there have to be at least 30 people stationed in the Azara. Source number 7, Amar Yitzchak. Ein HaPesach Nishrat, Ela B'Shalosh Kitos, Shal Shloshim Shloshim B'nei Adam. 3 shifts, each shift containing at least 30 attending witnesses or attending participants. Why? Shenemar, Kahal, the Eda, the Yisrael. So if Korban Pesach demands almost the abrogation of personal identity and the adoption of a collective historical identity of Kahal to reinforce our bris with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the bris which at that stage can only be entered as part of a people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't redeem individuals in Mitzrayim, he redeemed the people. He redeemed a nation that had transformed from a clan into a nation. This was our birth, the genesis of Am Yisrael. Sukkot is very different. Sukkot mentions individuality. Kol Hazrach Yisrael Yishruba Sukkot. Each person has their own identity. In fact, in the second iteration of Sukkot, source number 10, the Torah almost emphasizes the individual nature of sitting in a sukkah. Source number 10, Chag HaSukkot, this is taken from Parshat Re'eh, Tasa Lecha Shivat Yamin. That word doesn't appear for Korban Pesach. Chag HaSukkot, Tasa Lecha Shivat Yamin. And in fact, Rebbe Eliezer had many, many different shittos that are important about Sukkot. Eliezer, being one of the Kiva's rabbis, we mentioned before, he held that Sukkot were made from construction material rather than supernatural clouds. There are several different shittos of Rebbe Eliezer in the second parak about the manner of sitting in the sukkah. Rebbe Eliezer demanded that a sukkah actually be owned, not borrowed, in order to realize the personal nature of Chag HaSukkot, Ta'aseh Lecha Shivat Yamin. And even beyond the syntax of the pasuk, the directing mitzvah of sukkah is to live in our sukkah as we live at home. Teshvu, Basukot, what's the Gemara's drasha? That informs individuals. We live as individuals, we live with our family. Most of our sukkahs are related to this. A personal sukkah, the messianic sukkah, notwithstanding. In order to highlight the difference between those two forms of identity, think of the Megillah we read today. I know most of you are awake. I was only awake for half of it. Think of the Megillah we read today and contrast it with the Megillah we read on Chol HaMoed Pesach. Chol HaMoed Pesach describes the lyric of Jewish history, a love affair between people and God. That love affair can't be engaged in as individuals. It would be too audacious, it would be heretical to describe a relationship of love at an individual level. But as a member of Am Yisrael, Shir HaShirim resonates with historical relevance and historical compulsion. Today we read about individuals facing the meaning of life, existential crisis, death, futility, fatalism, hope, wealth, wisdom. These are experiences we encounter as individuals. We bear the brunt of our existence, and we bring our consciousness, and we struggle to make meaning of the conditions of our world and the conditions of our experience. So just the distillation, the offset between Koheles and between Shir HaShirim reminds us of the difference between the unity which is suggested in Sukkot and the unity suggested on Pesach. On Pesach, it's an abrogation of personal identity joining a collective. On Sukkot, it's a retention of identity, but integrating ourselves as individuals under that one sukkah. Even the providence and the hashgacha pratis of a sukkah is felt at both levels. We sense HaKadosh Baruch Hu's protection as a people. We also sense HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interest in preservation on a daily basis. When we rise every morning and we're healthy and we proceed and we navigate our way through life, we experience the Ribono Shel'olam's hashgacha as individuals. In fact, the companion mitzvah of Sukkot, not the Sukkot but the Dal and Minim, takes this individualism one step further, very famous medrash. Why the bouquet of Dal and Minim, of Lula, of Hadassim, of Rabos, and Esrog? A very famous medrash, source number 12. I'll paraphrase it. Some have aroma and produce fruits. Some have aroma without fruits. Some have fruits without aroma. Some have neither. And we bind them together to reflect the kaleidoscope of Jewish community. And we're all together standing in front of our Kodesh Baruch Hu. We're always celebrating our 50th anniversary. So when Rav Amital first founded the yeshiva, so the first class asked him, Rebbe, why do we need a yeshiva? We already have so many yeshivas. This is 1968. So he said, let me tell you a story. There was once a thief in Russia who was caught, and they tossed him into jail. So they said, call for the Rebbe. The Rebbe came into the jail, sat down with him, comforted him, and took him out of jail. A few weeks later, the same chassid gets caught, stealing, tossed into jail a second time. Called the Rebbe. The Rebbe comes in, consoles him. I also am tormented by my demons, and they walk out of jail together. 2 months later, the same chassid gets caught with his hand in the cookie jar a third time. Called the Rebbe. The Rebbe comes in, consoles him. Obviously, you're a kleptomaniac. I have my addictions. They walk out together. A few weeks later, the Rebbe dies. He's succeeded by the son. About 5 months after the Levaya, the same poor, wretched thief gets caught a fourth time. He's tossed into jail. They say, call the Rebbe. The Rebbe's dead. Call the son. So the son comes into the jail cell and starts lambasting this poor chassid. You're an offense to my father's memory. He was there for you through thick and thin. How dare you insult him by stealing so soon after his body's still warm. So the chassid starts crying. He says, you don't understand. I'm not a tzaddik, I'm a rasha, I'm a thief, I'm a ganav. He says, you're a rebbe for tzaddikim. It's easy to be a rebbe for tzaddikim, but I'm not a tzaddik, I'm a rasha. I need a rebbe for a shayim. Your father, he says, he was a rebbe for a shayim. I need your father. So Rav Amital said, there are plenty of yeshivas for tzaddikim. I'm going to open a yeshiva for a shayim. And that was part of his vision. To open a yeshiva as broadly as possible, without the center collapsing, to be as embracing in a land in which the terms of yeshiva have changed. Opening a yeshiva in Slobodka and then building a big wall between the town of Slobodka, or the yeshiva of Slobodka and Kovna, so that the Balabatim shouldn't cast their negative influence in the Bachur. But now we live in Israel, and the thems are us. They're now us's and thems. And how can we create an integrated yeshiva? And I'm always reminded of that story when I think about the lulav and that image of a broad spectrum incorporation of similar fruits. And of course, I think the real message behind Rav Amital's story was we're all the simple profiling of tzaddikim and rishayim is inauthentic. We're all sometimes a tzaddik and sometimes a rasha. There are parts of us that are tzaddikim and parts of us that are rishayim. Instead of preening around and cataloging ourselves at tzaddikim and rishayim, we should open a yeshiva where real people can come and try to improve themselves as best they can. So both the sukkah, kol ha'ezrach b'Yisrael, and the Dal and Minim emphasize personal identity, a personal identity corralled under one roof, bound into one bouquet, living side by side, influencing, inspiring, drawing from one another, in a way that Karm Pesach does. And those are two very different forms of collectivism. And in Eretz Yisrael, we're challenged, because in Eretz Yisrael, the Karm Pesach identity is so powerful, those of us who live in Israel, we have to hold ourselves sometimes from abrogating personal identities, almost as if all issues are resolved by this large vacuum called the State of Israel that sucks the air out of the room and that answers all of our issues and deals with all of our concerns. That's why it's here. And somehow we have to remind ourselves that we stand in front of a Kodesh Baruch Hu the same way we stood when we didn't have the State of Israel, with the same level of accountability, same degree of responsibility, of ambition, of ability to change our world, and that individualism can't be sacrificed for the powerful, compelling collectivism that we sense living in a state and living through a messianic era. And that's one difference between Kol HaEzrach B'Yisrael as opposed to Kahal Hadas Yisrael. But there's a second difference. And the second difference is not the question of what type of identity we adopt, but what mechanism we employ to create unity and incorporation. The Korban Pesach is a very interesting korban. It's probably the most civilian of all the korbanos. Very little blood is offered on the mizbeach, just one little delivery. Almost no part of the animal, in fact, no part of the animal makes its way to the mizbeach. It's eaten entirely. Most animals in the Beis HaMikdash, which are offered as korbanos, are torn apart limb by limb. It's a very, very messy business. In order to separate the parts that are offered in the mizbeach, the parts that the kohen receive, Korban Pesach remains intact, kirbal, krav, yochelo. It's really a civilian korban. But it's still a ritual. And it's heavily ritualized and heavily regimented. How it should be eaten, where it should be eaten, when it should be eaten. The bones can't be broken, it can't be cooked, and it can't be eaten raw. It has to be eaten before midnight. So there's a regimentation that comes from the ritual of sacrificing a Korban Pesach. Even though it's the most civilian of all the korbanos, it still attracts a lot of regimentation and structure. When the Torah describes a sukkah, there is no ritual act that's occurring. What's the ritual act of sukkah? Life. We eat in the sukkah. We sleep in the sukkah. We interact with one another in the sukkah. We surf the internet in 2016 in the sukkah. We invite our guests into the sukkah. In fact, since this is a mature audience, very fascinating conversation. Rav Nidan mentioned it the last time we were in sukkah. Should marital relations be conducted within the sukkah? If the sukkah is truly meant to house the full spectrum of human experience, then perhaps the sukkah, at least if it's private, should enable that type of interaction. And then, of course, the other dimension of the sukkah kicks in. Well, evidently, it's a sukkah of the Shechina, and it's a sukkah that's like the Beis HaMikdash, and maybe that type of behavior is inappropriate in the sukkah. There are different opinions. Again, in our situation, it's probably less relevant because most of our sukkahs are family sukkahs or larger situations that don't call for that type of private interaction. But the sukkah doesn't describe a ritual. It describes, as I mentioned before, teshuv, kein tadur. And those are also two different types of unity. Sometimes it's easier to envision, to achieve unity, when we're performing a common ritual. Right now, there's some degree of unity in this room. First of all, because we're all choking to death. Second of all, because we're listening to Torah. Or we stood this morning in Davin, or listened to Kohelet, or walked around through Hoshanos. And there's a feeling of community and unity that forms from common engagement in identical ritual. But then there's another form of unity. And going back to our model of living in Eretz Yisrael, we feel it very powerfully. The unity that comes from just living together as an Mizrach, living together in the same state. People who maintain ritual integrity, people who don't maintain ritual integrity. And to some degree, that unity is both more enduring, because we're able to extend it beyond the performance of ritual. When we leave shul, some of that unity dissipates. But when we live together in a holistic, organic fashion, we take the same buses, and we shop in the same makolets, and we serve in the same army, and we build the same state, there's a level of integration and fusion that surpasses ritual unity, that surpasses the shachatu osal kol kahal adas Yisrael. Kol ezrach bi Yisrael, yishru basikol. Of course, the problem with that is that inclusion sometimes prompts or invites dilution. And that's really at the core of our challenge in the national religious community. We're so intrigued by the prospect of inclusion, and we're so intrigued by trying to validate almost every member of our state of Israel, it's harder to create hierarchies of values rather than exclusive black and white. So I remember my time in Chutz Laaretz, it was very clear. There's black and white. Either you're religious, and you've got a strong sense of Jewish identity, and you're strongly immersed in the Jewish experience. And if you're not religious, at least the way I was raised, we know that not to be true. But at least from a developmental standpoint, it was pretty clear to me that the Judaism of those who weren't religious, who weren't engaged in Torah and Torah ritual and mitzvah observance, was flimsy, was weak. And in Israel, it's a lot more difficult. It's a lot more challenging because we validate and we certify so many different achievements, many of which lie well beyond the pale of narrow religious ritual. So, for example, we celebrate army service and army dedication even amongst those who aren't classically religious. And they're our heroes. And when they die, Chas V'Shalom, we commemorate them and we memorialize them, even though they don't live the life of a classic ritually engaged person, someone who's observant to mitzvahs and exhibits fidelity to the traditions of Har Sinai. Just a month ago, we mourned the loss of Shimon Peres, who everyone in this room looked at as a leader who had escorted the state of Israel through many of its pivotal transitions over the last 50 years, but he certainly wasn't an individual who maintained ritual fidelity in the classic sense. So on the one hand, we want to include and validate a broad range of citizens of Ezrach, and that word, which didn't mean Ezrach and didn't mean citizenship in the day, but today certainly resonates with a sense of Ezrach Yisrael, world citizens who hope to be citizens of the state of Israel. What? Ezrachut. And we validate others who aren't citizens, but that challenges us to maintain a hierarchy of values, all of which are important, but some of which are more important than other values. And this is educational, and as a Rebbe in Israel and as a father in Israel, is a task that you don't have to face in Chutz Laretz, because there, the balance of inclusion or exclusion, or that borderline, is more sharply defined. So the second offset between the inclusion of Pesach and the collectivism of Sukkot is not just the abrogation of personal identity versus the maintenance and the emphasis of personal identity along with that inclusion, but is it an inclusion which is achieved through ritualization, the shachatu also kol kehal adas Yisrael, or is it achieved just by civilian, normal, routine life? Kol ezrach b'Yisrael yishvu basukot. The third difference is probably, at least in my opinion, the most prominent one. As I mentioned before, the sukkah is not just a hut to shelter, not just a house to protect, but it's an encounter with a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Many of us are familiar with the famous term, Tzila Timeham Nusa, shadow of Kodesh Baruch Hu. The Gemara is aware of this. It's the only mitzvah in which the item of the mitzvah actually possesses Kedusha. Typically, the only items that have Kedusha are items which possess Hashem's name, Sefer Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzah. A shofar has no inherent or latent Kedusha. During the time of the mitzvah, it's inappropriate to disrespect the shofar. So if after blowing the shofar in between the kolos, the baltkiah were to use it as a straw, that would be irreverent to the mitzvah. But after Rosh Hashanah has passed, the shofar can be discarded. The lulav has no kedusha. It's just a branch. We perform a mitzvah with the lulav, but there's no reason to kiss the lulav or to revere the lulav, just to show it courtesy and decorum in accordance with the performance of the mitzvah. Ditto with matzah, ditto with almost every mitzvah. There's one exception, the sukkah. The Gemara says in Sukkah, Daptes, Chag HaSukkot HaSelecha, I don't think I included this, Kishem Shechal Shem Shamayim Ala Chagiga, just like a korban has Kedusha, Kach Chal Shem Shamayim Ala Sukkah. The walls of the sukkah are Asur Bahana. During Sukkot, you couldn't dismantle them and get benefit from them. The walls and possibly even the decorations, because they've been invested with a Kodesh Baruch Hu Shina. The Gemara compares the 7 days of Sukkot to the 8 days of the Miluim, source number 16, inaugurating the Mishkan. Teshvu, Teshvu, Ligzera Shava. Nemar Kan Teshvu, the Torah employs the word Teshvu regarding the Sukkah. The Nemar, the Miluim Teshvu. Those 8 days of inducting the Mishkan are introduced by the word Teshvu. Just like the Miluim was continuous day and night, similarly the Sukkah should be recited in day and night, thwarting or rejecting a Havamina that the Sukkah is only a day mitzvah as Lulav is. Lulav is a day mitzvah, but Sukkah is a continuous mitzvah. So the Sukkah is invested with the Kodesh Baruch Hu's presence. The 7 days of the Sukkah are continuous in the same way the Miluim, the 7 days of inducting the Mishkan, are continuous. And of course, Chazal saw the phrase in Shir HaShirim, your left hand is under my head, and your right hand hugs me. Source number 14, Smalo tachas l'roshi, v'imino tichabkeni, It's a very intimate description of our relationship with Hashem. Hashem is cradling our head with his hand and holding us with his right hand. What moment does this intimate allegory invoke? Source number 15. Smalo tachas l'roshi zisuka. V'imino techavikeni ze'anan shchina v'yasid lavo. So the sukkah is a foreshadowing of a more supernatural anan shchina in which we'll be immersed v'yasid lavo. So the sukkah, as I alluded to earlier, is not just a protection, but an encounter with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Now we speak of achdut, immunity, very freely, very glibly. It's a word which has become cliche and hackneyed. But there are three levels to unity. The first level to unity is what we would call tolerance. We have to play nice in the sandbox. We all live together in the same community, share the same planet. In the state of Israel, share the same small state. Remember a couple of years ago, we took the voice to the yeshiva. We're going next week. We'll be in the Old City for our Shabbaton, our annual Shabbaton. So a few years ago, we had the Shabbaton of the Old City. And we're trying to gather the chairs for the minyan at the Kotel, probably the hardest job. And all of a sudden, a boy inadvertently stole a chair from an adjacent minyan. And the man in the adjacent minyan let him have it. And they almost came to blows. So we had to intercede, and we calmed each side down. But the boy's very troubled. He expected the Kotel HaMaravi, turban-clad women, sandal-wearing men. This is the Kotel of his imagination. And he shows up at the Kotel, and he's berated for stealing a chair. I tried to explain to him, this isn't Tinek. So this is if we can each build our own shul, and our own community center, and our own school. We have one Kotel, and we have to share it. And most of the time, the sharing is cordial. But every once in a while, as we're sharing common resources, we have limited resources, I think every once in a while, people irritate each other.
This is the first thing.
So the first level of unity is just to tolerate one another. I call that moral unity, moral tolerance. Just like we tolerate people who are different. The next level of unity is not tolerance, but cross-pollination. The recognition... Thank you, Rick. Thank you. That we all gain and benefit from the investments of people and communities who are different from us. So it's now 11:40. Don't worry, I'll end this year early because it's comfortable in here. It's now 11:40. There's just been another Sefer published in Bnei Brak. And if you wait another 5 minutes, there'll be another Sefer published in Bnei Brak. And I spend my entire afternoons reading through those Sefer. Because the level of mastery, which these svarim exhibit in these quaint niches of Talmud and Shas, are just amazing. I'm the beneficiary of that community's prodigious and unprecedented investment in Talmud Torah and publishing Torah. So we've styled a community that's more attentive to national needs, to army service, to building a society, to engaging in government, to engaging in professional life. But we gain immeasurably from the investments of others. You wouldn't make an orchestra with only sound instruments. You have sound instruments, percussion instruments, wind instruments. So, just like a symphony is enhanced by the diversity, our lives are enhanced by the diversity of our community. So it's not just tolerating people who are different from us. It's recognizing that we gain, we're enriched by different communities' specializations and the things and the agendas which they target. The Gemara says in Brachos that a person sees 600,000 Jews, the amount of Jews who were in attendance at Har Sinai, he should recite a bracha. It's a very interesting bracha, as I imagine for thousands of years, Jews were befuddled. When will I ever see 600,000 Jews? I'm living in a pashtunk and a shtetl of 20 Jews. And now that we live in Israel, this has actually come to fruition. There were some people who hired helicopters during the Ravadji Yosef's funeral, just to take them up in a helicopter, recite the bracha, go bungee, no, and then that'd be my bracha. I two for one deal, bracha and bungee. But they recited the bracha, and they landed, because according to some positions, you can only recite the bracha if you see everyone at once. So you have to see them from a high perch. But some people just recited the bracha, because we could never envision these mass funerals, which on the one hand are sad, but on the other hand, when they celebrate the lives of these great Gedolim who live in Israel, They're almost testimonials to our presence here in Eretz Yisrael, to our collective presence. Remember, my Zaidi told me about the Chafetz Chaim's funeral. The largest funeral in Europe, the New York Times covered it. I always wondered to myself, how many people actually made it to the Chafetz Chaim's funeral? Maybe 100,000. I can't imagine the train systems were able to carry more than 100,000 people in some backwater in White Russia community. And here we have funerals of 800,000 people. So the content of the bracha is you're thanking Hashem and you're praising Hashem, kishem shepartzufeim einam damos zol lazol, just that people look different, and we're happy that people look different. That's why we're attracted to different people, we interact with different people. Kach deo seem shamos. Only you could mint them with different ideas, different perspectives, different emotions, different personalities, different identities. How many identities can a human mind conceive of that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can mint an unlimited number? So it's not just tolerating people's differences, but appreciating, cultivating, advancing, and recognizing mutual enrichment. And the highest form of unity is standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and recognizing that no human mind can grasp the total extent of Hashem's infinity. And that every human being, as accomplished as they are, only achieves partial truth rather than complete truth. The Gemara in the end of Tainus describes the final alignment of the tzaddikim. Hashem will align the tzaddikim in a circle, and a Kadosh Baruch Hu will occupy the midpoint. And all the tzaddikim in the circle will point to the midpoint, and they'll say, Zeh Hashem kivinu lah. Why do you think the final alignment is compared geometrically to a circle? Not a square, not a triangle, not a rectangle. What makes a circle geometrically unique? Infinite equidistant radii. You're equidistant. So let's say, for example, you occupy this part of the circle. I'm using my kippah for demonstration. And let's say a ger chassid resides on the opposite end of the circle. You are 180 degrees apart. You're seeing things 180 degrees different. But you're both seeing equivalent portions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the statement, the proprietary statement that your derech is the derech, is not just a morally offensive statement, it's a theologically bankrupt statement. I tell Tamim, the two words that anyone employs, seriously, should cause you to walk away from that chair. Walk out of the chair. In a disrespectful way, to walk away from that Rebbe. If any Rebbe says, this is the Derech, that's a factually incorrect statement. There can't be one Derech. It doesn't exist. The proper terminology is, this is my Derech. This is the Derech I've been taught. If this Derech inspires you and attracts you, I'll be happy to teach you and share it with you. There isn't one Derech. It doesn't exist. The same way there isn't one Derech of Talmud Torah. The MS Derech, the MS of Hashkafa, and the Derech to learn Torah. Torah is a reflection of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinity. No one human being can encompass this totality. I wish I had 1,000 lives to study it 1,000 different ways, and then I just get started. I have one life, very little time, so I have to try to find the approach and the methodology that suits the allocation of resources. It's a very demanding task. So this is my derech, the derech that my Rebbe taught me and his Rebbe taught him, and if you feel it's an appropriate derech, I'll share it with you. But you can't monopolize. And that was another one of Rav Amital's. We once asked Rav Amital, which are the only hashkafos we shouldn't be interested in? You know what he said? Any hashkafa which says it's the only hashkafa is not hashkafa. Really, everything is appropriate unless it stakes the claim to exclusivity. Once it stakes that monopoly, then it renders itself inappropriate because it doesn't exist. Kol hazrach b'Yisrael yeshvu basukos, that encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in an immersive sense is meant to cause that realization. The same way standing in Har Sinai caused that. Vayichan sham Yisrael neged ahar. Famous Rashi. Ki ish echad b'lev echad. It wasn't incidental that it occurred in Har Sinai. When they sensed the magnificence and the magnitude of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, their own positions were humbled. Their own egos were stilled. Their own proprietary stakes to understanding God were framed. And they realized that no one person can grasp this total sweep. Everyone will only achieve partial knowledge. By piecing together, each part of that puzzle will create that larger sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wholesomeness and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's sleep. That's a unity which only the Sukkah can provide. Korban Pesach does provide an encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as every Korban does, as it did in Mitzrayim. So it's not immersive. It's not 8 days in the same way that Sukkah is, or 7 days. It takes a while to process that sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's transcendence. It's a beautiful Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara Brachos describes the bracha which the outgoing shift of Kohanim provided for the incoming shift. Every Shabbos, the shifts switched. So the Kohanim who had served for that week took the lechem apanim, their breads, they moved on. And the incoming shift. So there's a nice little conversation between the arrivals and those who were departing. And those who were departing turned to the arrivals and they said, Kodesh Baruch Hu should give you the peace and acceptance and recognition of one another that we've achieved. Spending that week in the Beis HaMikdash, you'd think rivalries would fire, you'd think there'd be contention, there'd be disagreement, who gets to serve, who gets to offer the karban, who gets the meats. But standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu for that long created that reductive effect and allowed people to recognize multiple truths, coexisting truths of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in ways that boggle the imagination because we're so binary. For us, it's night outside, it can't be day. In a few hours, it'll be day, it can't be night. For HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yod Se'or, Uvari Choshech, Aseh Shalom, Uvari Asakol. I can't explain it to you because I'm binary as you are. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides coexisting truths. People make the mistake that a machlokes, a dispute in the Gemara, is the product of the deterioration of the Masoros. And Har Sinai Hashem provided one truth, and for thousands of years, people understood and maintained that truth, but as study habits weakened, and as the transmission became corrupted, they forgot that truth. Not at all. HaKadosh Baruch Hu provided multiple truths in Har Sinai. He said, you see this item? It's Tameh. And there are 49 different ways to prove it's Tumah. You know what else? It's also Tahar. And there are 49 ways to prove that it's Tahar. And strong minds close enough to the source were able to integrate those seemingly diametrically opposed truths. Niels Bohr, who was a Dutch physicist, once said, the opposite of a true statement is a false statement. The opposite of a profound statement is a profound statement. And I've seen HaKadosh Baruch Hu deliver profound statements. And that's why we spend so much time excavating every detail of Shas, every position. But we don't paskin like that idea, we don't rule like Beis Shammai, it doesn't make a difference because every position contains an encapsulation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wisdom. And every position and that's the unity which a sukkah is meant to provide. So just to summarize, Chazal sensed an overlap between Pesach and Sukkot. The overlap is thematic because protection began the night of Mitzrayim, Leil Shimurim, and the encounter began the night of Mitzrayim. Pesach, as you know, doesn't just mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu skipped over our homes, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu hovered over our homes as we offer the Karban Pesach, and the Shekhinah engulfed the home, preventing the angel of death from invading and executing the firstborn of the Jewish people. So it was a night of protection, a night of revelation and encounter. And then those experiences, which were so supernatural and miraculous, the night of Pesach, became incorporated throughout the desert in the form of the Sukkot, the shelters which were fashioned from heavenly clouds. Chazal and the Gemara and Sukkah sense the fusion through the term Tetvav Tetvav, and they drew a halachic conclusion. The first night of Sukkot is as obligatory as the first night of Pesach. Hence the minhag to outlast the weather, if possible, the first night of Sukkot, Baruch Hashem in Eretz Yisrael. We rarely have that challenge. But in Chutz La'aretz, you can always tell those people made Aliyah, you don't need nefesh b'nefesh. Whenever it rains in Israel, everyone walks to shul, to mincha, a little sullen, except for the B'nai Chutz La'aretz. Yes, what is Sukkot without some rain? Part of Sukkot is the obstacle course and the challenge and the weather and the Sukkot fooling, Sukkot Dovet and Ophelas. Baruch Hashem, the weather is so clement and so delicate that we don't have to face those challenges anymore. But beyond the Tesvav, Tesvav halachic bridge is a very intriguing portrait that emerges both for Pesach as well as for Sukkot. And it's a portrait of solidarity. But the terms of that solidarity are very different. When the Torah describes the solidarity of Sukkot, it employs the term kol ezrach b'Yisrael. When the Torah describes the solidarity of Pesach, kol kehal adat v'Yisrael. Each Gemara derives vastly different halachic information from those terms of solidarity. The Gemara in Sukkah is preoccupied with whether ownership is required for a Sukkah. The Gemara in Kiddushin and Pesachim is concerned with whether shlichus is available for shlichus karban Pesach. But that same takeaway of unity is described, but described very differently. On Sukkot, individuals enter a Sukkah separate growths, branches, fruits, aggregate without abdicating identity. Pesach is an abdication of personal identity in favor of a collective historical identity. Our encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu was a calibration of the two. I think sometimes in Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Lichtenstein would speak with us about this very, very often, and he would actually contrast Israeli boys and Chutz-Lars boys, and he would tell these American boys, we had too much individualism, we had to become more collectivist. And he would sometimes tell the Israelis that they were too collectivist, and they had to become more individualist. And he would contrast it between the writings of Rav Kook and the writings of Rav Soloveitchik. And Rav Kook was wildly popular in Eretz Yisrael, necessarily a collective, even panoramic, inclusive identity, which Rav Kook speaks about. And the rabbi's much more existentialist, much more of a human being, individually standing before HaKadosh Baruch Hu and wrestling with the questions of life, with the questions of meaning, the difference, as I mentioned, between Koheles and Shir HaShir. The second difference is, what's the methodology for unity? Is it a ritual, Purim Pesach? Or is it just life? Kol HaZrach B'Yisrael Yishuv HaSukkot. And Baruch Hashem, the challenge in Eretz Yisrael is that we, for the first time, we have an opportunity to create unity. We hope that one day, everyone will perform similar ritual experiences. A part of our challenge, and we're happy to face that challenge, is to include people who aren't engaged in ritual, but are living with us side by side, under a historical warrant, facing a historical challenge, hopefully showing the courage and the bravery that we expect of ourselves and of them. And then finally, it's not just the methodology of the unity, but it's also the encounter with the Kodesh Baruch Hu and Sukkot that creates a unity, which I'm not sure Pesach is able to achieve. So let's just conclude with a very famous Sukkot, which took place when we came back from Babel. We've all come back from our Babel, from our Ashurs, at different stages. Some of us are journeying back, many of us are visiting, but all of us are in different stages of being back. The first year they were back, they opened the Sefer Torah, source number 18. By Yitzhak Kasil Torah, they discovered an unknown halacha in the Torah. What do they find in the Torah? Ezra and Nehemiah. Asher yeshu b'nei Yisrael basukot, the chag ha-chodesh ha-shvim. You should actually sit in the sukkah in the seventh month. They put out words. They put out the announcement throughout all the cities. Go to the mountains. Collect olive wood. Collect hadassim. Collect tamar wood from tamar trees and date trees. Make a sukkah. Because I actually left out the final pasuk. Pasuk Yitzayin, because sukkot had not been celebrated since the days Lisav. Yeshua ben Nun. Sukkot had not been celebrated in close to 1,000 years. That's impossible to imagine. 1,000-year hiatus of Sukkot. Evidently, it wasn't that Sukkot wasn't celebrated, but a particular aspect of Sukkot had been omitted. If you look at the highlighted pasuk, it's pasuk Tezayin. Vayitzu ha'am vayaviu. They collect the wood. Vayasulem sukkot, ishal galgo. Each person makes a personal sukkot on their rooftop. But not only on their rooftops, ubachatzoseim, in their courtyards. Not only in their courtyards, ubachatzos beis elokim, in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash, in our bayis. Not only the Beis HaMikdash, uberechov shar hamayim, the public square, the public commons. Uberechov shar Ephraim, near the gate of Ephraim. Evidently, in 1,000 years, they hadn't created collective sukkot. Individual sukkot they had, but at some point, the slow erosion of our peoplehood, 10 tribes disappearing to there, people being exiled to Babel, our social fabric being frayed by idolatry and corruption, the unity that was so central to sukkot, that could only be realized by collective sukkot, had begun to disappear. And now upon returning as a people, with the identity of the people who had chosen to return, and perhaps with a nostalgia for those who hadn't returned, because there were 41,000 who returned, but hundreds of thousands who didn't. And perhaps the collective sukkah became a lot more compelling to these people. And those were the sukkot that hadn't been built in 1,000 years. And those were the sukkot that Ezra and Nehemiah supervised. And those are the sukkot we're trying to build in Israel, both literally and, of course, figuratively. As we intake people from different climates, I was listening to a station here, a radio station on the way driving in, Kurdish melodies for Rosh Hashanah. Never thought I'd listen to Kurdish melodies for Rosh Hashanah. But that's the magic of living in Eretz Yisrael and being able to recapture all the vectors of Jewish peoplehood and Jewish culture and have them washed together under one roof and under one country. And Sukkot is the time we remind ourselves that one day we'll all sit together in an actual Sukkot, which only HaKadosh Baruch Hu can construct, and we'll reside and enjoy and identify with Kol HaTzrach B'Yisrael and Shri Basukot. Chag Sameach, everyone. Hopefully.
A month ago, I became president, so...